Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behind the badge.
He is in the studio with me. My name is Elizabeth Alfano. I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy. Those two fabulous people will be back next week, which, hey, is 2017. So I was here yesterday, and I'm here today filling in for the fabulous duo. So like I said, singer-songwriter Steve Dawson is here in the studio with me. He's going to join me in just a minute. But right before we got on the air, I was chatting with my producer, extraordinaire. Okay, he's actually Bill and Wendy's producer, but since I'm subbing, I'm going to call him my producer
as well.
I'm
yours, don't worry, it's fine.
Ah, that's what I like to hear. Kevin Richter. So we were chatting just a bit.
Yeah.
Everyone's dying. What's going on?
It's been a rough year. There's been a lot of celebrity and musician deaths, and yeah.
Well, and particularly in the music world. Now, of course, I'm bringing this up because Debbie Reynolds passed away last night. On the heels, literally, of her daughter, obviously, Carrie Fisher, passing away. And it's just like a 1-2 punch. I want to say this in the right way, so please don't call and hate on me, people, because I mean this in the good spirit. But it's almost comedic timing, the way Debbie passed.
Yeah, like, I saw something about it. Was like, of course, you know, she has to outstage her daughter,
yes,
even in death or something like that.
It completely seems like that. And anyone, I mean, I'm being tongue-in-cheek, people, of course, because it's sad. But the movie Postcards from the Edge, did you ever see that?
I'm not familiar, unfortunately.
Okay, so Carrie Fisher wrote that about her life when she was coming out of a drug addiction and almost overdosing. And the whole movie is also about their relationship, you know, her relationship with her mother, Debbie Reynolds, and how her mother is constantly upstaging her. So even here in death, Carrie's not going to get the last word. I don't know. But beyond Carrie Fisher and Debbie Reynolds, again, so bizarre and sad, you just look at who we've lost in the music world. David Bowie, George Michael, Prince, Glenn Frey, Leonard Cohen, Keith Emerson. I mean, the list is really long. And what's freaky to me is a lot of these people aren't that old.
No.
George Michael, 53.
I know. And Carrie Fisher, I think, was 60. That's super young.
So, yes, I define this as downright young. So my niece is going to visit me after the show, who is 21. She may not see it as young, but I'm telling you, people, 60, it's young.
Absolutely.
So it's just, you know, it's always a sad part of the year when you think, okay, now we look at 2016 and who have we lost? So, and of course, so many more people that I haven't even mentioned, Harper Lee, Edward Albee, I mean, Nancy Reagan, lots of, I don't know. But of course, we are here with the living today. And a living musician, exactly, specifically, is here with us in the studio. So Steve Dawson, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me in.
So you are the lead singer-songwriter for Dolly Varden, of course.
Yes, that's true.
In Chicago people, you've probably seen him somewhere playing around with Dolly Varden, I would hope. And a singer-songwriter in your own right. Now, I also have seen Dolly Varden all around town, but specifically I know you because of your teaching at the Old Town School of Folk Music.
Right. Yeah, you took a couple of classes, didn't you?
I want to say, and I'm sad that I'm fuzzy on this, I think I took two classes.
Yeah, I think so too.
I think I felt that I need, because first of all, I loved it so much, your songwriting class at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And then I felt that I got so much out of it that it wasn't repetitious at all for me to actually sign up and take that exact same class again.
Cool.
And it's so funny that you and I have connected because you've put out a book, Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You. Just when this book came out in October, I was saying to myself, I have to recontact Steve Dawson because I'd like to get myself into one of his classes again. I feel that I could benefit from taking that class a third time.
Wow.
And
cool.
So I wanted to, you know, and now I'm in LA a lot. I work there and I also work in Chicago, of course, my hometown. I will never leave it. So I'm back and forth, and it makes it a little tricky to get in a class when you're not here every week. And then lo and behold, you made a book as if it were just for me about how to write songs. So I want to talk about this book, but before we get into that, maybe you could give us a little of your history. Take us back just a little bit and talk to me about how you got into music and mm-hmm. how you got into songwriting specifically.
I've always been a music lover since I was a little kid. I remember listening to Beatle records and, you know, using my mom's tennis racket as a pretend guitar to, you know, try to, and watching the Monkees and loving that show. So I think it was always destined to be. And then in seventh grade, they offered guitar as an elective, and I took it.
Seventh grade,
yeah, in the Idaho public school system, which is pretty shocking and awesome. And I took a guitar class with this sort of like hippie woman named Miss Terry, who changed my life. You know, she loved music so much. And she loved John Denver so much. So we learned all the John Denver songs, but we didn't just learn them. Like, she got inside the songs and was like, what is John thinking in this song? Like, what is he trying to say? So I was like, songs weren't just a vehicle to strum chords. They were important, meaningful things. I think that made an impact on me. And then, you know, as I learned to play guitar, my parents and my aunts and uncles and my sister, everyone was buying me songbooks, which at the time, that was the way you learned songs. So I got, you know, I got a Beatles songbook, of course, but I also got like Neil Young and Paul Simon and Bob Dylan. And I just started learning all these songs. And I guess I thought at some point, well, I guess I should try this. You know, it seemed like the natural progression. Like, all these guys wrote songs, and I'd never heard of them because I was pretty young.
So you mentioned a couple of things there that really strike me. First, the power of a good teacher.
Right, yeah.
Obviously, there were other things going on that led you in this direction, because, and we'll talk about this later, maybe after the break, you know, sometimes you say you don't even have that much joy in writing. Just you're so driven. You're almost catapulted into doing it. So obviously
right.
there are other things going on in your particular makeup that send you to music and songwriting. But the power of a great teacher, someone who can inspire you early on, I think, and again, we'll talk about this too throughout the show because you're with me for a whole hour. How you can train yourself to be creative, to kind of work those juices. And when you get in the groove early on, teaching your mind to think that way, it's like any other habit. You know, every morning you get coffee, every day you work out at noon or whatever, every day you read the newspaper, and you also can force yourself to sit down and be creative. So the power of a great teacher.
Yes.
But also, whenever I do have the time and I'm disciplined enough, another subject we'll talk about, to sit down and play piano, which, you know, I learned as a kid and I've never been very good, but it does give me a lot of joy when I can stick with the discipline. I'm better at math and I'm better at reading. So my reading skills like double in terms of speed and retention.
Wow.
And my math does as well. In terms of just like scratch on the back of a newspaper, I have to pay some bills today. I'm better with numbers and manipulating them, and I'm better with reading because I've been in music.
That's interesting. It's interesting that you noticed that, too.
I can see an immediate jump.
Wow.
And I mention this because, if you don't mind saying, how old were you? What was the year, actually, when you were in Idaho taking
That would
have
been
lessons?
1977, 78.
So what are the chances that Idaho still has funding for guitar lessons?
Yeah, that's probably
not a
chance.
I'm pretty sure that that's gone, right? Yeah, I could bet on that with some good Matilda beer and be sure that I would win that bet. It's probably not around. And gosh, that's really a shame. So we rely on people like you more than ever giving lessons at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And I am going to give the hugest plug possible that everybody should take your music class. Really, it's so good in so many ways.
Thank you.
And we're, of course, going to talk about that as well right after I go to break, which is already here. But I'll be back with Steve Dawson. So sit tight.
You with the scissors and me with the thread, smile knowingly at the newlyweds. But now's not the time for truth, you said. So we danced through the night instead.
Ah, the luscious sounds of Steve Dawson, and I believe that's Diane Christensen there.
Actually, that's a woman named Ellen Cherry from Baltimore. We made an EP together this year that came out this spring.
Okay, so that's not with Dolly Varden, then.
That's not. No, that's a separate project.
Ooh, throwing me a curveball. and I will say, for the record, your wife, Diane Christensen, does sing with you and
do backup harmonies. Yeah, we've been singing together for almost 30 years.
Yeah, almost as long as you're married, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, okay, so let's go back to your teaching at the Old Town School of
All
Folk
right.
Music. How did you work teaching into your portfolio of life, basically?
Well, it was a transition from sort of actively touring with Dolly Varden through the early 2000s. And we took a break with the band because we'd been pretty actively touring through like 99 to 2003. And then the rhythm section both got married and had babies. And we decided to take a little time off.
So they were in sync?
They were. They were totally in sync. Their kids were born like within months of each other.
Wow.
It was funny. And I needed a better way to make a living. I'd been working in a record store for far too long. And so a friend of mine, Joel Patterson, was working at the Old Town School of Folk Music. And he said to me, "Steve, you'd be perfect for this job." And I always thought, well, I thought that place was pretty cool, but I'm not really a folk singer is what I thought. But and it's sort of a problem. I don't know if it's a problem, but the school has so many facets and so is so sort of like expansive that the folk music thing is kind of limiting in the name. But it's also an honor to a tradition. So so anyway, I applied there and I got hired, and it really has changed my life. I mean, I think teaching is it feels really natural to me, and I get a lot from it, and I think the students get a lot from it.
So you've been teaching since 2004? No.
I started in October 2005.
Okay.
So like 11 years.
11 years. Yeah. And your classes sell out all the time. I know that I got booted from a couple classes, and I was waitlisted, and it didn't come through, and I was like waiting for my class with Steve Dawson. Okay, so one of the things that I love about your class, which is just songwriting, basically songwriting 101, right?
Well, they've renamed them now as songwriting fundamentals.
Yes.
And continuing songwriting.
Okay. Yeah. So you can take either. I don't think I even graduated to continuing songwriting. But I'll say, for anyone who is looking for just a tiny creative outlet, not changing your life, not looking to support yourself and your kids on music, but just a tiny bit of expression. So writing the great American novel, huge, big ordeal. Writing a little snippet song might be 30 minutes, might come to you on the L, might just even encourage you to have a notebook that you keep with you, even if you never write anything down in it. But the fact that a song could come together, an idea, a riff, a lyric, a catchy phrase that this could, inspire you on the L. Just even that belief that kind of comes from taking Steve's class is worth the class in and of itself. And what I loved about this class, so anyone looking for a little creative outlet, excellent. This class and this book, Take It to the Bridge, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside of You, really demystifies the process and lets us know that basically anyone can do it.
Excellent. That's exactly the point. And that's the thing I learned in teaching, is that just people walking around that you would never suspect are songwriters in disguise. I've had so many people come through that have written these beautiful songs out of the blue that had never tried before. And, prior to teaching, I always thought it was this kind of rarefied thing. But, people are meant to be musical. I think it's part of who we are. And just, I think the word unlocking in the title is really correct. Because once you sort of like open that door and say, okay, I can do this now, things start to show up.
Yeah.
So, it's a wonderful thing.
So you lead me to a great quote by Isabel Allende, who says that when she's writing, she shows up, she shows up, she shows up, and eventually the muse shows up as well. So again, another point about this isn't that you have to be extra super talented. Maybe talent isn't even necessary at all. You just have to be willing to show up, give yourself a half an hour on the L to kind of focus just on scribbling some ideas down, or, you're 20 minutes before you go to bed at night, or whatever. The smallest bit of time, if you can do it consistently, again, you know, this book I think would be very helpful. So if you can't get to the Old Town School of Folk Music for a class, there is this book. But just to scribble down thoughts and ideas and then start to shape them to basically the format that anyone can learn, because you already know it. You sing so many songs in your head. You already know the format of a song, basically verse, verse,
right.
chorus,
right.
verse, verse, maybe bridge, maybe not. So not only can you just kind of write the song, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but is it the music first or is it the words first? But you don't even, and I was completely floored when I learned this from your book, you don't even need to be able to read music or necessarily play an instrument.
Oh, no.
Explain to me how that could be.
Well, I think music is an oral tradition. Popular music is an oral tradition. And, you know, anyone can sing in the shower or sing along with the radio. There's musicality in what you do. There's musicality in speaking.
There's musicality in speaking.
So you already know. I mean, I think one of the big points of the book is you already know how to do this. It's just basically the book more or less gives you permission to try and not say, well, I can't do that. Of course you can do it. You're already doing it.
Right.
I mean, everybody sings little songs in their head. It's just a matter of finding something that's interesting to you that you feel like singing. And I do think it makes you a more content person and maybe a more compassionate person, because you're looking around and expanding your view and thinking about feelings and how things affect others. I mean, I just think it's any creative enterprise is expansive and makes you, hopefully makes you more content.
I think that's actually right, because there's a lot of power in having a voice. And even if no one ever hears what you ever do, there's a lot of power for yourself in just using your voice.
Right.
That not just the vocal cords, but your thoughts and expressions through creativity. There's
right.
a lot of power in that. But all this chit-chat about power, we're about to go to break, but I wondered if we could get a quick song right in before we do.
Sure. You were playing up at the top a song called Obsidian. I thought that was one that I was going to play. So they've already heard the intro. So
hit it.
I'll just play that film. You should know by now, everything you say will be misinterpreted. Turn around right now. Every step you take leads you. Come on now, obsidian. Soften your skin, let the change begin. Come on now. The soft clay of your heart is a place to start. I pray that you can. You should see yourself contorting into shapes to try and re-explain yourself. We would all just laugh if it wasn't such a shame this time. It's a matter of life and death. Come on now, obsidian. Soften your skin, let the change begin. Come on now, the soft clay of your heart is a place to start. I pray you can. Come on now, come on. Oh my gosh, Steve Dawson in the house. We got to go to break. We will be right back with Steve Dawson.
Didn't realize till I spoke the words that it would break her heart.
Singer-songwriter Steve Dawson is here in the studio with me. My name's Elizabeth Alfano. I am filling in again today because I was here yesterday. I am filling in for Bill and Wendy. They're going to be back, hey folks, next week, which is the new year. So before we went to break, we were talking, Steve Dawson and I, about can you teach yourself some of the tools to creativity? And if so, does this mean that anyone can be a singer-songwriter? And I think the answer to that is yes.
Yes. If you allow yourself, yeah, you just give yourself permission to do that, you can do it, yes.
And so I think some of the things that trip people up, in addition to fear, which is the ever big tripper, is, you know, some of the nitty-gritty, like what comes first in songwriting, the music or the words?
Well, the truth is it works best if they come more or less simultaneously. As soon as words are married to music, the idea of turning it into a song or having it have sort of flow into a song, it makes more sense. The most trouble I've seen students have is where they'll write an entire lyric and then decide to set it to music. Or vice versa. If someone's written this beautiful guitar piece and then say, well, now I just need words, I was like, you're doomed.
Really?
Yeah. It seems to me it works best if you can sort of like have them hand off. So if you get a line of lyric, attach a melody to that, and let that melody determine the rhythm and the syllable count and all that stuff towards the next line of lyric. Oh, and it's have it sort of like step together.
That's really helpful. So they sort of inform each
exactly.
other, which is, yes. I guess, ideally, now that I mention it, now that I say those words, it sounds like, okay, that does make the most
yes.
sense.
Yeah, otherwise, I mean, if you have a lyric that has sort of like odd syllable counts or that the lines aren't symmetrical, when you try to set it to a melody, it just has a randomness that is just not conducive to music.
So, mm-hmm. yeah. And again, your book, Take It to the Bridge, co-written by the ever great Mark Caro, journalist Mark Caro, and you yourself, Steve Dawson, has a lot of exercises in the back
yes.
of how to get people started, because I think sometimes starting is just the hardest bit of all. If you can put aside that fear that, you know, I'm not good enough or I don't have talent, or, you know, all that stuff we all tell ourselves, okay, just take that whole thing, get rid of it. All you have to do is sort of give it a chance.
Right. So I've been teaching songwriting at the Old Town School for over 10 years, and I've, you know, done literally hundreds of assignments because I give a weekly assignment in the classes. So this is basically the best of, like, assignments that I've made up. And the ones that seem to keep coming back because they're useful, especially in the songwriting fundamentals class. So, like, you had mentioned the thing about the photographs, and there's a really basic approach to syllable counting and to melody writing and all that kind of stuff. So that it's sort of like, I don't know what you say, test marketed through the
through the years of Old Town School of Folk Music classes.
So which ones work the best and seem to, you know, turn the lights on best for people trying this out.
And you've been teaching students, as we said, for 11 years. Do sometimes students surprise you? People
oh,
who
have
never
God.
Tried it before and then they come out with something of a doozy?
No, it is. It is consistently inspiring and often overwhelming how good the stuff people come up with is.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that to me is sort of life affirming as people can just kind of get it out there and then there you have it. There's something from nothing.
Right.
So tell me about yourself. What kind of success do you feel from this? So I always think it's so hard being a musician. I mean, all the art forms are difficult in terms of struggling to survive. But music, I mean, so very few people really hit it big with this cash that comes running through because they've had a pop smash. So
right.
if you know that, or if you accept perhaps early on that you might be one of the gazillions that don't get that, how do you define success for yourself?
Well, I mean, it's changed as I've gotten older. I used to, you know, be pursuing that sort of brass ring through my 20s and into my 30s and, you know, got pretty close with major label deals and all that kind of stuff. But as I've gotten older, and especially since I've been teaching, the success is more about creating things that I'm proud of and things that feel true and have some kind of value, lasting value, not monetary value, that the work is more important than any sort of outward success. Outward fame, I guess, or notoriety is not as important as the work itself. I mean, it really has become like a calling, and I guess it always was, even as a little kid. It was like I always wanted to make music like the music I loved. It wasn't so much that I want to be famous and all that kind of stuff. So,
well, I think what you do has lasting value, not just your classes at the Old Town School of Folk Music and not just your new book, Take It to the Bridge, co-written with Mark Caro, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You, but your own original music itself. So I wondered if you could close us out. You see, this
sure.
interview goes so fast.
Yeah.
It's like you just got here. I wondered if you could close us out, take us home, and give us one more live
sure.
song. Here is Steve Dawson.
Break the skin medicine, fill this fever dream with hope. Steal the blood, make it good, give a reason clear to cope. It is long overdue, it is long overdue. Pack your books, meet the train, you are gonna have to run. Wait a minute, don't you panic, there is time now to forgive. It is long overdue, it is long overdue.
Gosh, Steve Dawson hitting the high notes with me here in WGN Radio. Thank you for being here.
It
kills
so
me to say goodbye because I know that there's so much more we could talk about with songwriting. But if anybody's interested, he gives the greatest classes in the world at the Old Town School of Folk Music. His book, which really helps anybody, the average person off the street, can write beautiful music. His book, Take It to the Bridge, co-written with Mark Caro, Unlocking the Great Songs Inside You. Steve Dawson, thank you for being with me today.
Thank you.
If anybody liked that and you want to see it again, you can go to my Facebook page because I did videotape both of his songs today. So you can go to my Facebook page, Elizabeth Alfano, or you can hit up my Twitter or Instagram, Dinner Party CHGO. Both of those videos will be on. My name is Elizabeth Alfano. I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy, and I'll be right back after the break. That's the music of the Websters taking us into the second hour. My name is Elizabeth Alfano. I am filling in for Bill and Wendy today. I'll be here till just about noon. The fabulous Bill and Wendy are going to be back next year, which is 2017. Just in case you somehow did not know that, which I'm sure you all do, New Year's Eve is just upon us any minute now. So very fun. I have Aaron Packer, art curator, gallerist, Aaron Packer in the studio with me. Aaron, how the heck are you?
I am fantastic, thank you.
So you and I go way back.
We do.
I've known you. I was looking at the calendar the other day. I had to like pull out the calendar and check out the years. I think it was 1993, but it could have been 1992 that I met you in the Flatiron Building right around the Coyote.
Right. And but your gallery did open by that point or not quite yet?
I believe, so taking you back, people, I too had a gallery. I had an art gallery from 1993 until 2001. My gallery started in Bucktown, which is where I met Aaron Packer. But I think I met you in maybe 1992, before the gallery actually opened.
Yeah, I think I remember you coming in or something saying, I'm going to open a gallery
and
down
I have
the
no
street.
Idea what I'm doing.
And you seem focused, so what's up with it?
Yes.
And I thought we had a great run. I was open in the Flatiron Building from late 92 to 98. You know, the fall of 98, and I had a great 5-year run there. I loved it.
Well, so that leads me to a really interesting segue. You talk about you had a great 5-year run in the Flatiron Building, but you're still doing it. You've been doing this now for 25 years, but you're always changing spaces. So tell me where your space is now, but also maybe you can take me through the history of the many galleries, like you say, like the many faces of this person or that person, the many gallery faces of Aaron Packer.
Yeah, I've had quite a few spaces. And at the moment, I basically am a nomadic gallery, which sort of is back to my roots. But if I can short form it, let's see. You know, my history is apartment gallery in 87 for many years, and I used to do antique shows. My mother owned an antique quilt gallery. Then I geared towards renting that Flatiron Building eventually. And then
a space in the building.
A space in the Flatiron Building.
You did not have the entire building.
I did not have the entire building. And then from there, I did 2 years of what I'm doing now, sort of nomadic. I did shows at Gary Marks Antiques. I rented Northern Illinois' gallery for a big show. And then I eventually joined Michael Lyons Weir, who is now in New York. So we were Lyons Weir Packer for like a year and a half, 2 years. And then that's when I went to the West Loop on Peoria and Randolph, and I did that for 5 years in a space that is now filled by partially by Rona Hoffman. And then from there, I went to Packer Schaff Gallery, which was on Lake and Morgan, for 9 years. And then for the last year and a half, I've been nomadic and have probably done like eight different shows over eight different periods of time in four different places.
So this does really speak to your original roots, because the artwork that you like to show is outsider art, and you now show contemporary art as well. But outsider art, which usually means that the people creating the art don't come from a traditional background of studying, and you know, they may be self-taught, they learned on the street, they may or may not have been homeless at some point. They have just a very different take on the art world. And so it's interesting that you now are sort of bouncing from space to space and, like you say, nomadic. Why are you nomadic at this point?
I think after 9 years of being in the really big space, everything's changed. The whole art market has changed in a small sense. You don't necessarily have to have the space. You know, I still have a big internet presence. You know, things are, you know, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm doing that a little bit, if not a lot, depending on who's helping me. And it's really cost effective also. People don't visit as much as they used to, because for the last 10 years, people have been living through the internet. You know, it's much easier to visually see a show. At least you can get an idea what a show is by going online and perusing, you know, 20 different pieces in a show. And so my theory now, as it was when I first started, was to have usually a Friday night opening and then open Saturday and Sunday and maybe a gallery talk on Sunday afternoon. And that's almost like a pure condensed show.
Well, so now your shows, which used to run about 5 weeks when you had your own proper space that you were renting, now that you're taking these shows kind of on the road, they are as long as a weekend and that's it?
Yeah, weekend, or, you know, I do miss doing longer shows because people don't realize that things are so short. And sometimes they do know, and so that's fine. I do miss it.
Well, sure. And also, it's a lot of work to mount a show.
It
so
is.
We talk about this general word, a show, but you're mounting an art exhibit. So you're doing all the hanging and you're people have probably shipped you artwork. So you're uncrating it. And then after a weekend, would you crate it back up?
Well, no. I'm trying to keep things simple for myself, relatively so. Lately, I've been doing either small, like 3-person shows where everybody gets a wall, or I do one solo show and it's, you know, in general, a local artist. I did a big show with 15 artists at Co-Prosperity Sphere in Bridgeport. And I think I got one artist to ship me something. And then everybody else, I definitely am good at planning and wrangling. That's probably one of my strong suits. And, you know, fixed it so everybody brought their work, you know, in a staggered way, and, you know, didn't kill myself unwrapping things. And then the same, the show's over, come and get it, you know. And then if somebody's got a special case, you know, I'm good at dealing with it.
So really you're asking the artist to come and hang the work, and then you're kind of organizing the collectors, getting them in, selling the work, getting the work promoted, maybe even getting things written about the artists in journals, reviews, etc.
Well, it's definitely getting the artist to bring the work. They don't hang the work. I hang all the work. I'm very, very specific and very very picky. That's got to go 1 inch over that way, and your idea is terrible. We'll do my idea. That doesn't look good next to that. That kind of thing. I'm real. That's another strong suit. I hang shows. I mean, you know, so many different artists and galleries hang shows, but I like to think I've got some special tack hanging a show.
So that's kind of cool to think that that's your knack. I'm wondering, what is it that has driven you to do this for the last 25 years and at the same time not do your own artwork?
I love, you know, I sort of feel like I'm an artist, just in terms of putting on shows, and that's my, you know, special thing. You know, my mom was a Sunday painter, and like I said, she owned an antique quilt gallery, and my dad was an exhibition designer and an industrial designer, and so he actually used to design the booths for AT&T when the Consumer Electronics Show was here in town, and, you know, any number of other companies. And so he and I would always talk about the placement of things, and, you know, whether I realized it or not, I was sort of a product of my parents. And, you know, years ago also I did artwork, and I still have artwork ideas, and I would love to get around executing them, but, you know, not sure I have the energy or the time anymore.
But you get the thrill from being around it.
Oh, absolutely. I love artists. Fantastic. I'm totally driven and addicted to it still.
Well, that's interesting. The artist or the artwork or both?
I think, you know, in the long run, you know, more the artwork. Although I, you know, I'm a people person and I love people, and most of the artists I work with are unusual in one way, shape, or form, and some more so than others. And so I like wrangling both people in the artwork.
And I think often people don't realize how much work the gallery owner, gallerist actually does. And so it's great to have you here talking about this, because I think there is sort of, as you say, an art form in and of itself to hanging the show, bringing the right artists together, getting work that's cohesive, and having a vision for the impact that this art can have. You know, sometimes artists do so much work, but of course they're spending their time creating, so that artwork could just sit in their garage, you know, but you're kind of bringing it to the forefront to people. So it's a great service, honestly. I would say it's a great service. With that, I'm going to head to break really fast. We'll be right back after the break with Aaron Packer. That's the music of the Websters, taking us into the other segment that we have here with Aaron Packer. Aaron, thanks for being here.
Thank you again.
So you are a gallery owner, and you've been doing this for about 25 years, but in different spaces all over the city. That's another fun thing. It's not just that you're moving your spaces. It's that I feel your presence has been felt in Bucktown, in West Loop, in River North, and then also in Rogers Park where you live. Sometimes you run things out of your house.
Out of my house, and also doing things in Evanston, too, of all places, which
wow.
is like we live...
So close.
Right
Rogers
at the end
Park.
Of the city. So
yes, so close.
We're right there.
So talk to me a little bit about collectors. Right before the break, we were talking about artists and how you represent all these unique, different people. And as much as you love the artwork, you also love being around the sort of quirky artists, I'll say. But of course, the collectors are kind of quirky in their own right.
They are absolutely as quirky, especially if they're super serious, you know, if they're into having their collection speak for themselves.
So my folks, and you know my mother, of course, who says hello, My folks were big into paperweight collecting. So this kind of just gives an insight into the world of the collector, how they can be so specific. So anybody who doesn't know, paperweight is that 3-inch, give or take, round glass dome that you see every once in a blue moon, because they're pretty rare now, on someone's desk or maybe on a mantle. My folks chose to really focus on that one odd, obscure thing, and they only wanted paperweights from the 1850s. So just to show you, like, collectors have their own very small focus, odd obsession. I mean, they're obsessed.
I'll say this is a phrase I'm thrilled about at the moment.
Yes, I know everybody says that. Why paperweights? What would drive them to paperweights? But they just feel that the artistry, particularly in France, between like 1847 and 1850, I mean, actually, to be really specific, they're interested in like 1847 and 1848.
Oh, my.
I know. And they're obsessed with anything that could have come out of there. So you must have some obsessed collectors yourself.
Yeah. I do a lot of different things, and I try to throw a lot of different art darts, for lack of a better thing to say, and not so much to see what sticks, but I have a broad interest in a lot of different things. Like you said, I do outsider art and folk art, and that's what I'm most well known for, even though almost 90% of everything else I do is actually contemporary art, and I love that too. And we love showing different materials. We have Brian Detmer, the artist who cuts up books in a crazy way. We have, you know, other artists. I have about 10 fiber artists because of my quilt connection with my mom, somebody who does embroidered x-rays named Matthew Cox. Kathy Halper does embroidery of, you know, pet portraits, and then she does more serious work about being in her mid-50s and seeing where her life has gone. And, you know, Ellen Green, who's like, you know, embroidered dresses and then dip them in wax about where she is currently in her life. So, and then also I'm really big on really fine painters, like hyperrealism with surrealist aspects and the occasional abstraction.
So what's so neat about this is, you know, you've mentioned in many ways a bunch of obscure things. So dresses covered in wax. And so some people might be listening to this thinking, like, what would someone do with a dress coated in wax? And this just general thought might keep them from going to a gallery, thinking like, I must not get it, because since I don't get the connection to the dress in wax, maybe I won't get the art gallery, or maybe I shouldn't go, or maybe it's just for a certain kind of person, or maybe it's just for the obsessed collector. So I can't stress this enough. That is wrong. Galleries are for everyone. Would you agree?
That is absolutely the same. I was listening to the Steve Dawson segment, and everybody can be a songwriter. Everybody can enjoy a gallery. And, you know, I don't know if everybody can be an artist, but there's no reason you can't try. And but galleries are definitely like a free and open thing in general. And it's always great to just walk in and check them out, especially if I have only 3 days to do it with my next show or something like that.
So I'll add to that, that maybe everybody can't be a successful artist, but everybody, I think, can try their hat at being an artist.
Sure, why not?
So we talk about, like, galleries are open to the public and they're for everybody. So I'll just give a couple plugs here. Galleries are free, people. So free entertainment, right? Wouldn't you
right.
say? And I
sure.
don't mean entertainment in a negative way of, you know, commercial entertainment. I mean, like, this is your brain on art, you know? Like, your brain gets really jumpy and when it gets all the stimulus. So it's a free way to really kind of challenge your brain.
Agreed.
And I'm going to say, taking somebody to a gallery, huge first date brownie points.
Absolutely.
And one of the great things about a date that happens at a gallery, again, free, just in case free didn't come through the first time, it is free. But, you know, it's a conversation starter. So sometimes when you have a first date, you're thinking like, uh-oh, what are we going to talk about? Because I don't really know this person. But now you can talk about the art. Do you like that? Do you not like that? What do you think they're saying here? I don't know. That's sort of weird, but I kind of like it, and I'm not sure why. So immediately you have all these conversation starters. So I always tell people, like, everyone's been to a first date at a bar or a restaurant. Go to a gallery.
Yeah, much, much better afternoon, you know, break the ice thing.
Even better. You can do it in the afternoon. Yeah. So perfect for a first date, particularly if you're like internet dating and you don't want to meet at a coffee house again because like the barista at the coffee house knows you through all your first dates. You want to go someplace else, go to a gallery.
Or the Friday night
Friday night, first
Friday openings or second Friday or whatever.
So if anybody's interested in that, I can, of course, send them to packergallery.com.
Correct.
But those are the things that you should do in a gallery. Basically, go. What are the things you shouldn't do in a gallery?
You for sure should not touch the art unless, you know, I recently had a show by a blind artist named George Papadakis, and you could, it was actually okay with me if you picked up the work because it was sort of sanded and softened by a rasp and sort of pleasant to pick up. But in general, you shouldn't even get your fingerprints on even a bronze sculpture. I think, you know, that's why the Art Institute, they say don't touch the artwork. And fingerprints often show up on a painting or a drawing, or you just don't want to do it.
Yeah, so I'll add to that. Well, I was saying earlier that I also had an art gallery, and that's how we met, we think, in 1992, although it could have been 1993. And my gallery was glass only.
Yeah.
So I can tell you, you really don't want to be touching that. And what would really bug me is when people would come in and they would have fake acrylic nails, and they would tap on the glasswork to see if it was glass or acrylic. So that's a no-no. If you're going into a glass gallery, you're not allowed to tap the artwork.
Yeah, and, you know, I want to be always open to people, so I try to be as friendly as possible, and, you know, either me or somebody that was working for me, like, practically say hello immediately.
I was
so
the same.
To be super friendly and welcoming, and not so much if you have any questions or, you know, if you want to buy something, let me know, but more just like, hey, come on in, if you have any questions, let me know. And, you know, I don't even necessarily say that. I just say hi in a really happy way.
Yes, yes, yes. Because it is all about sort of opening up your mind and your eyes and your senses. And so you want everyone to just be welcome and feel as welcome and open as they can.
Absolutely.
So what do we have going on now for you? What's the next show that people can see? And again, you can get information at packergallery.com, but just tell us what you got on the docket.
I have four shows scheduled for the year, although the dates aren't exact. I'm going to do a show at Space 900 in Evanston, probably the end of January with Karen Pearl, who's a great painter of cityscapes of Chicago, mostly. Really fine sort of Edward Hopper-looking things.
And how long will that be up? Just
that'll
a weekend?
That'll just be a three-day weekend.
Fast.
Deal, maybe, yeah, and maybe it'll go 2 weeks, but not much beyond that. And then probably in March, we're going to have a woman named Cassie Marie Edwards, and she is a painter of almost like single sculptures, like a cat sculpture or a brass trophy of a fish or something like that. And she sets them up by themselves with a, you know, maybe a simple, you know, sort of acid green background, and is very, makes sort of like abstract marks, but the whole thing ends up being, you know, a portrait of this odd object. And she is fantastic. And I don't know where that show's going to be yet. I really want to make a good choice with that. And then we're going to have a show at an event space called Concord 55. Right near the Hideout on Elston and Concord, and with a guy named Hank Feely. And he's somebody who used to work at Leo Burnett and then changed his life and went to art school later in life after he had an early retirement, and is an offbeat artist who lives part-time in Florida and part-time in Traverse City, or not Traverse City, but Glen Arbor up in Michigan. He's a real, and he's an eccentric, even though he's a regular straightforward artist who went and got a BFA from the Art Institute. Cassie, I forget where she went to school, but she's a little offbeat also. And then Karen Pearl is somebody I've known for years and years and years, and I'm pretty sure she has a degree, but she's a sort of straightforward painter, but sublime.
I love it. Aaron Packer bringing the art to the people, taking it around town, literally from Evanston to, you said, near the Hideout. So you're really going to cover all bases. Aaron Packer, gallery owner, taking art to the people. If you want to check out any of those shows, folks, packergallery.com. We're going to hit a break. Aaron, thanks for being with me.
Very grateful. Thank you so much, old friend.
So I'm back. My name is Elizabeth Alfano. I am filling in for Bill and Wendy. They'll be back next week. I have Chef Matt Wiltzius here from the Lockwood of the Palmer House Hotel. I have to say, welcome to you. You have spoiled me. You've brought me three things to eat, which, be prepared, people. I'm going to eat them. What have you brought me?
We brought a few things today. We brought our handmade spaghetti that we do in the restaurant. Pasta is something that's like really important to me, so we hand extrude all of our spaghetti. Then we have a burrata on a little bit of toasted sourdough, a little bit of fresh greens on top, a little bit of honey from our roof, which we just harvested about maybe 3 weeks ago. And then you also have a little pocket. I just saw you bring out a little bit of maple syrup there.
Yes, I did.
we barrel age maple syrup in our basement downstairs, so we had quite a bit of maple syrup that we get. And then we take different barrels of liquor that we get, Woodford Reserve, different tequilas. We do Grand Marnier, things like that. Fill it with the maple syrup, stow it away for a few months, and it brings a really crazy, like, unique flavor. So each maple syrup had its own special flavor.
Okay, so there's so much I want to talk about here, and pasta. We're getting to pasta in just a minute, but I think you had me at barrel aging your own maple syrup.
So this particular one is Woodford Reserve. So we've been partnering with Woodford Reserve for quite a while now. We have our own barrel program, which means, you know, we went down to Woodford, picked out all our flavors and nuances, how long we wanted to age it for, different casks and things like that. And then they actually send us the large 55-gallon barrel to us. And then we take those barrels, or smaller barrels if they send us smaller barrels, fill it up with maple syrup, stick it in a nice, cool, dry place, and then bingo.
So are you telling me that my maple syrup, the maple syrup that I'm holding in my hand right now from the Palmer House Hotel, is going to have like a little bit of alcohol to it?
It's going to have a little bit of alcohol, not very much, because it does kind of seep through the wood of the bourbon. Part of the bourbon experience, they call that the angel share. All the bourbon that's like left in the wood comes out if you were to put anything in it. So theoretically, you could take water and dump it in there and you would, you know, kind of squeeze a little bit more bourbon out if you wanted to. We just happen to use maple syrup. So.
You are singing my song, baby. That is great. Maple syrup and a tad bit of bourbon. That just works for me.
Perfectly. And it goes great on pancakes, French toast, all those great things for the morning. So people really love it.
And now talk to me a little bit more about this pasta, because I've had, in the break, I had a bite of that. Well, I had three or four bites of this. And the pasta itself is so rich. You can tell that it's handmade.
You know, at Lockwood, we kind of call ourselves like a pseudo steakhouse. You know, we don't really do the traditional steakhouse atmosphere. Not everybody in the city can afford $80 for a steak. So we acknowledge that. That's not who we are. We do other particular cuts. But with that, we need to have the vegetarian options, the pastas, the salmon, the fish, and all that. I personally love pasta. It's one of my most favorite things. I love to make pasta. I love to cook pasta. All about it. So what we did is we extruded it. We got a brass pasta extruder from Italy. I think I got it maybe like 10 years ago. And basically you just shove the pasta in it, turn a crank a little bit, and then out shoots fresh extruded spaghetti. So all of our pasta that we do in Lockwood is either hand extruded, either sheeted, things like that.
And here's one of the crazy things about pasta is it's a little bit like songwriting, which is how we started these 2 hours together, because I was talking to Steve Dawson earlier about songwriting. Anyone can make pasta.
Absolutely.
And I know everyone thinks like, oh, I have to buy this in the store because I could never do this myself. But it's actually not true. There are very few ingredients to pasta. It's eggs, water, flour, right?
That's it. And sometimes not even eggs.
Oh, like, you can have eggless pasta?
Most like mass-produced pasta you get in the store, it's just semolina flour and water, and then they really just under high pressure, and that's how they make it. That's why you can get like shelf-stable fresh pasta, because there's really no egg in it. It's kind of just flour and water. But as far as like restaurants go, or you're going to make it at your house, fresh pasta, you don't even need a bowl. Just throw it on your table, mix it with your hand. You don't even need a rolling pin. You know, I'm sure you got PVC pipe or something laying around. Anything like that, you know.
Pasta made with PVC pipe.
Done, you know.
It's a new one.
Roll it, cut it, throw it in the water, and you're done. You know, it will change. It changes everything.
Wow, so you roll it and cut it and then throw it in the water, right? You don't have to, like, leave it out or let it come together? Or,
you know, everybody has, like, their own technique. There's a lot of people that say, you know, let it sit for 5 minutes before you cut it. You know, let it dry a little bit. If you're going to make a lot of it, it's nice to let it dry a little bit or portion it into little piles and then you can freeze it. But other than that, if you are hungry right now, roll it out, throw it in the water, and you're good to go.
Oh, I like the way you think. Okay, so there are a bunch of special things going on at the Palmer House Lockwood Restaurant. So, okay, you're aging your own maple syrup, which, of course, so very important. You're making your own pasta. I just learned that you have, probably not working for you right now in almost January, but you have your own rooftop garden.
So we do have our own rooftop garden, and we have about, I would say, what do we have, like 12,000 bees up there working for us last year. And we harvested pretty late this year. So we, along with all of the herbs and a lot of things like that, and we do get some greenery up there, we also get our own honey from our roof. So we use honey in just about everything. So whipped ricotta, on a dish, dressings, things like that. And it also helps to pollinate all the flowers and the herbs and things like that. So this year we really tried to focus on getting as much of like petite garden garnishing herbs as we can, things that are really strong and pungent flavors. So like on the dish that you have right there, those little red flowers are called sorrel.
On the burrata.
They're extremely strong in lemon flavor. So
I'm going to try one.
A little bit goes a long way. So, you know, our roof is not the most biggest roof in the world, but it's definitely enough to suffice the restaurant for the spring and summer months.
Oh, my God. Tell me the name of this again. So much flavor is coming out of this little leaf.
That one little leaf. Yeah. It's called sorrel. That's red lucky leaf sorrel, actually.
Oh, my gosh. Spell it for me. Sorrel?
S-O-R-R-E-L.
Oh, my gosh. Wow. So I hadn't realized you were doing so much in-house at Lockwood.
Well, you know, we try to do as much as we can, but we also realize that, you know, we're the second biggest hotel in the city.
Sure.
You know, we have, 1,400 and some odd rooms. And our clientele is extremely diverse. So there really is only so much that we can do. So we do try to partner as much as we can. And I call it partnerships because I don't, we go out and we find someone that's really good in their craft.
Yes.
You know, like let's say I wanted a sausage on the menu. I can't make sausage for 300 people every day, but I know who can. Paul Kahn can make sausage.
Paul Kahn can make sausage. It's true.
So if I would like sausage, I would go to someone like that. I can't make bread for everybody, so I go and find someone that can do it. La Farine Bakery, a small bakery, great. I go to them to get their bread.
Yes.
So it's not that we don't make everything in-house, but if we don't make it, we're going to find somebody in Chicago, which is local as we can get, and we're going to get them to make it for us.
Well, we have to take a break because basically I've got some eating to do. So the station has some commercials they want to read. Fine by them. I'm going to do some eating. I'll be back in about 3 minutes with Chef Matt Wiltsius. Everybody, I'm Elizabeth Alfano, subbing for Matt and Wendy. They'll be back next week. I have the very talented Chef Matt Wiltsius here in the studio with me. He is the chef at the Lockwood Restaurant, the Palmer House Hotel. So tell me what's going on with this burrata that you just brought me.
So it's a whipped burrata dish that we do at the restaurant. We whip it with a little bit of ricotta and cream. Makes it very silky and smooth. We season it up with herbs. In the summer, we season it up with all the fresh herbs from the roof. Lavender is one of the main ones, so you kind of get that really fresh flavor. And then to kind of make it sweet, tons of rooftop honey is as much as that we can do, and serve it on a piece of crusty bread, and that's pretty much it. You can't go wrong with that.
Oh, my God, and I'm tasting lemon in here. Lemon and honey?
So then there's a little bit of a dressing on top, which is, again, a little bit more of that honey from the roof. And then just simple lemon, a little bit of Dijon sprinkled on top. And
it's amazing how really you don't need that much. I know maybe it sounds like you have a lot of ingredients there that you listed, but you just need fresh ingredients.
I'm a really firm believer of, there's two different kinds of restaurants in the world. There's the kind of restaurants that are, white tablecloth, which are in their own right extremely difficult to do and very, very hard. And then there's the kind of restaurants that do extremely simple food. But believe it or not, sometimes the simple food can be just as hard because as a chef, you like to overthink everything. And if you just keep it simple, keep it back to the basics, and usually you'll kind of – everybody will really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's usually almost like a foolproof system. Going back to the basics, keeping it simple with natural ingredients, hard to go wrong.
Can't go wrong.
Although, talk to me a little bit about the pressure that you might have working at the Palmer House, such an enormous institution, not just a large institution, but historically so important in Chicago. And I believe it's the birthplace of the brownie.
Absolutely.
So how do you follow things like that up?
You know, the Palmer House, and I've always said this, and we kind of talked about it before, it has been the hardest position I've ever had, but it's also the best position I've ever had. I've never felt more fulfilled than working at the Palmer House, and it's because of that pressure. It's because of the day-to-day grind that never really ends. But we have a great team. We really do, from every single one of my cooks to every single one of my stewards to the team above me, to my directors, to my executive chefs. Every single person stands by us 100%. And without those people, it's just truly not possible.
And you have worked at many hotels in your life. So the James Hotel, the Waldorf Astoria, which I believe you were here in Chicago, the Waldorf
Astoria.
But the Palmer House is really something special.
Well, and before I started at the Palmer House, just about everybody I talked to was like, oh my gosh, the Palmer House. I'm not originally from Chicago. I've been here for about 12 years now. So,
but you're from Wisconsin, so we're gonna cut you some slack.
I kind of know a little bit. Maybe okay. I was here when I was younger, so I wasn't too familiar with the Palmer House and how much everybody knew about it. But as I started talking to people and mentioning it to different people's grandmothers and aunts and uncles, they were like, "Ooh, the Palmer House," and I'm like, "How does everybody know about this place?" And then once you get in there and you see the beautiful lobby and you see just the experience that you can something really truly creative, it's like, okay, this is why people remember this hotel. Because they just don't make hotels like that
No,
anymore.
They don't. They don't at all. It's such a very special experience. So I'm always amazed when I have a chef and I say, okay, you're cooking for hundreds of people and you're working your craft and you're honing in on making the best possible dishes with the best possible ingredients. What do you cook for yourself at home? And they always say, like, grilled cheese.
Skinny pop and ramen noodles.
No way. Wait, ramen noodles out of the styrofoam plastic
bag.
Like
the cheaper, the better. But no,
so bad.
Not just like straight up ramen. You know, I spice it up a little bit, and that's just literally like a dash of sriracha and butter. But like, skinny pop, the bigger the bag, the better. If you think you found the biggest bag, you haven't, go to Costco. They have like this, a bag the size of small.
You can go bigger.
There is a bigger bag of skinny pop out there. I'm quite confident that there is. I think a lot of chefs kind of think that way. It's just because, you know, we spend a lot of time in the kitchen with and around food. The last thing you want to do is go home and be like, all right, let's make a 14-pound rib roast and vegetables and throw it in the oven and this and that. And then it's like you go to Whole Foods, and the next thing you know, you spend, you know, $700 and you have the best ingredients possible. And it's just like, you know, you spent your whole day cooking.
Yes.
I just did that the last couple days. I kind of want to just enjoy my time off. And to be honest, you know, there are certain things that I do love, and I do love a good bowl of ramen. And there are places in the city that have amazing bowls of ramen. But at home, honestly, ramen and skinny pop is kind of like my soft spot.
Well, so it's funny that you mentioned this, because I have a show called The Dinner Party that I do outside of this radio show. And so I always ask people, you know, who would you like to have dinner with? Or you as a chef, who would you like to cook for? And I'll answer for myself, I love to cook for chefs because they're so grateful, because they're always cooking for everybody else. So I love to have chefs at my own house. And people say, the pressure, how can you take it? They're always so grateful that somebody else has spent the time, because they really know what it is to cook. So I always like to have chefs over to cook. Who would you like to cook for?
Me, the favorite, my most favorite is sometimes I kind of just hang out in the lobby at the Palmer House, and you see these like wandering lost souls, kind of, where they're like, I would like to go see a ballroom. The ceiling is pretty. I'm kind of don't know what's going on. I just yank them.
No.
Sit them down, get them a drink, get some food ready. You know, obviously see if they got, you know, maybe an hour to spare or whatever. And that is my most favorite experiences. And we do it quite often. And they absolutely love it. And that one experience, they could have the worst time in Chicago ever. They could have a bad cab ride, the airport sucked, all this kind of stuff. But that one experience, and that's kind of what dining is all about. That's kind of what food is all about. That one little thing, they will remember that for the rest of their life. Even if the food was just, I didn't really care for it, it was subpar, they will remember that time. And I really do think that random person that maybe is not accustomed to having something a little bit more on the fine dining side to experience that and like open up their eyes, that's my favorite.
I think that is beautiful. That speaks so much to the history of the hotel, that you would just take people, and that management at the hotel supports this and gives you the budget to be able to just take people and unexpectedly change the course of their entire day.
Well, you know, and quite often, like, you know, later on at night, we do see a lot of people that's just like, can I just get a peek at the Empire Room? Like, you know, Frank Sinatra, is he still in there? Like, you know, I kind of want
to know. Yes, he is. We've embalmed him and back.
Exactly. And those are the kind of people that really came there to experience the Palmer House. And sometimes we just don't, you know, if it's late at night or whatever, we're unable to do that. So whatever we can do to, like, really show them, like, this is the Palmer House. It's the least we could do to, you know, some people that save up for, you know, half a year to have that trip to Chicago or whatever, and then they come to the Palmer House, and then let's say all the ballrooms are booked for the day, and they're kind of like, bum, I really wanted to see that. All right, I gotcha. Let's do this and this, and we'll have a little bit of this, and we'll just have fun. And most often it ends with me just sitting at the table with them, talking about this and that, asking about where they're from, eating dishes right out of the same plate they are or whatever, and it just becomes like a my friend for the day or whatever, and they absolutely love it. So.
That is so fantastic.
And I love it.
Because that really is what food is all about. It's about connection.
Absolutely. I'm a firm believer of that. You know what? To me, when I go out to a restaurant, I don't even really care about the food. You go out for the experience.
You do.
You know, like we were talking before, you can make pasta at home. You can make steaks at home. What you can't do at home, you can't paint the theater of the Palmer House in your house. Nobody can do that.
Right.
You can only come to the Palmer House for that. Or any other restaurant that has whatever feature they're looking at. So it really is about creating an experience, not so much about the food. It's the service, the atmosphere that you're in.
So you do eat out at restaurants from time to time, because I always like to ask chefs that as well, because sometimes they're in their own kitchen so much they don't even want to be in a restaurant setting.
Yep.
But not you.
You know, I have this strong, like, I love cocktails and interesting cocktails and fun cocktails, because that's one thing I can't do. I'm not good at it. I'm not, you know, I try my best. I do whatever. So when I go out, I really like to look for something that is like someone that's going to show me something that I have not seen before and something that I know that I cannot recreate at home. Mm-hmm. So I tend to gravitate towards places to where I'm going to try something, a new cocktail that I've ingredients that I would have never thought to put in a cocktail. And that kind of gravitates my mm-hmm. restaurant experience.
So you're always going for the experience. So a couple quick questions before, sadly, we have to end. So what is the one thing that everybody should know how to cook?
Stock.
Ooh, like a vegetable or chicken broth stock?
Any kind of stock. It's really not a particular dish, but if your stock, for whatever reason, vegetable, chicken, beef, if that is perfect, the rest of the meal will be perfect from then on out. And to be honest, I have not mastered it. I've only known one person in the city that has mastered it. It was my butcher at the Waldorf Astoria, Jimmy Burns. He'll love to hear it. And I've called him so many times, like, Jimmy, what am I doing wrong? I'm doing something wrong. I'm literally following your directions to the T, and something's just not right, and it's a little bit off. And because of that, it has changed my bolognese, which I used to sell at the Waldorf, which we still sell at the Palmer House. But there is something that's just not correct, and it's because Jimmy's
not
amazing,
there,
and Jimmy's not—he's not making my stock anymore. So,
oh my gosh, I've had that conversation with other chefs before, particularly Chef John Mannion of La Serena Clandestina. They're just something. You see this a lot with sort of Mexican grandmas. It's just not going to be the same if the Mexican grandma isn't making it. So, you know, all of the food can be very particular to the person actually making
Absolutely.
It. Absolutely. And what if you're a chef? What is the one dish that chefs judge each other on? So they sort of, is there a standard like, his souffle, that's not it, so we're not going to call him like a real chef? Or is there one dish that every chef really competes on?
Not so much a dish, but, you know, like in culinary school, there was one thing that they drove into our head, and it was called NFG, non-functional garnish. So when somebody puts something on a plate like this massive 6-foot sprig of rosemary, okay, every chef looks at that and says, what are you going to do with that? Are you going to floss your teeth with that? Are you going to take it home and scent your bathroom when you're done with it? Like, there's no purpose to that. So anytime we see a NFG, a non-functional garnish on a dish, the first thing that pops into our head is, all right, maybe we'll go to the next restaurant. You know?
Interesting. I love that, how form follows function even in cooking.
Yeah, and sometimes no garnish is better than a garnish at all. You know, like sometimes just a simple splash of parsley or chopped chive is more important than a hand-picked microgreen or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so I have one question for you on the way out, if you can, one word answer. So New Year's Eve is coming. New Year's Eve resolution.
Schleps your bag.
Done.
Okay, awesome. Thanks so much for coming in. We're going to take a quick break and then come and wrap it up.